The information shared in this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. It should not be considered as professional legal advice or a substitute for seeking professional legal advice. I'm Michelle Locke, and this is Love, Lust, Raw. You've heard me on Love, Lust Fridays, and you've heard me on my own show, Love, Lust, Law. And now today, Jake and I and Gabby, who we have dragged in, are going to get real. Normally, our Love, Lust, Raw episodes have a little more levity to them, but because January is Stalking Awareness Month, which is a cause that is near and dear to both Jake's and I's hearts, this one's a little more serious. Let's get started.
I want to talk to you about the comments that you're getting on a reel that we posted about Stalking Awareness Month, what people have to say about how mental illness plays into stalking. People are saying that the person, the raccoon in the pink socks story, he was schizophrenic. People are up in arms and saying you have to have mercy on people with a mental illness.
There's a huge mental health component when it comes to stalking. There's a couple of reasons why. If you look at the, from my perspective, the stranger stalking, it's when the celebrities have the stalkers that they've never met, don't know, or you're getting stalked by someone you've never met, don't know, right? For someone to do that is a whole level of obsession that does not exist in what, and there's no such thing as normal, but in normal personalities. In order to have that kind of obsession where you ignore norms of society, where you ignore boundaries, where you basically think you are entitled to do whatever it is you want to do to get that obsessive needs met, it has to be a mental health disorder. It has to be. While I am not a doctor, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a psychiatrist, I can't diagnose. Everything I do is within my lawyer knowledge 101. One of my lawyer friends tell me about a judge that will say or has said in the past, I didn't need an expert to tell me that person was crazy. Because sometimes it is just so obvious that there is something wrong with that person. And that is, I think, abundantly the case when it comes to stalking cases.
One of the things I do want to mention is that you have to basically separate the condition from the behavior. And This is one of the problems that people have is where, yes, we should have sympathy for mental disorders. We should have sympathy for psychological issues. But when it comes to behavior that infringes or harms other people, that's where the line has to be drawn.
100% agree. Schizophrenia, my understanding, again, I'm a lawyer, so I'm sure there'll be a mental health expert that tells me otherwise. But I don't even think schizophrenia really hits until adulthood. I think most schizophrenia diagnoses occur post 25. And there are certain mental health disorders that cannot be treated or have limited abilities to be treated with pharmacology. That's just the reality of it. Like they will say that if you are truly diagnosed, my understanding is that they will say that if you're truly diagnosed with like borderline personality disorder, it takes a minimum of 20 years of intensive therapy for that borderline personality disorder to start getting better. And that also requires the person with borderline to acknowledge they have it and to actively work towards their mental health. I will tell you, I don't think you can ever cure a true person with narcissistic personality disorder. NPD, I don't think, is one that you can treat at all.
There's so many modern advancements when it comes to treatment, not just psychotropic drugs, but there are things that ultimately can lead to what's your family history with these kind of things. You know, what kind of incidents or situations set these things off? Imagine a scenario like this, okay? Michelle, you as a former judge would have someone in your courtroom and they have been accused of stalking, let's say by another party, a significant other, someone who they're going through a divorce with. Have you ever had the opportunity to examine that behavior and address what are the origins of that stalking behavior in this situation? Have you ever had the opportunity to like basically call someone out and say, why are you doing this?
I don't think in what I do for a living, I really get much of an opportunity to say basically what's wrong with you. I do remember one particular case where the girl was being stalked by the guy that came and dropped the fruit basket off or the edible arrangement off at her house at like 6 a.m. And I remember he was one that I'm like, what is it you want? And what he told me was, I just want her to tell me that she doesn't want to be with me. And so I stopped and I said, okay, I'm going to tell you right now. She is suing you in court. I don't know how much clearer that she can get with you that she doesn't want to be with you. She is suing you in court to keep you away. So that's probably the only time where I'm like, what's the deal, dude? And it was, well, I just need her to tell me that she didn't want to be with me. And so I took over and I'm like, I'm telling you now, she's suing you in court. She didn't want to be with you.
Someone in your position might be the best ammunition when it comes to dealing with stalking, because you're in a position where for once they're being held accountable for their behavior. No matter how many restraining orders that happen, no matter how many social media accounts get deactivated, no matter how many gifts get sent, you're the person where literally the buck stops there when it comes to those things. So I think that in some capacity, when you actually have someone who's accused of stalking or an actual convicted stalker in a courtroom, that is probably one of the strongest opportunities to be able to get to the bottom of why these things happen and ultimately figure out what the next plans are. And I know you're limited by the laws. I know you're limited by the proceedings of the court, but I still think that very often we don't have a stalker in a situation where they literally have to appear and they have to be there confessing or sharing why they conduct this behavior.
So I think that's true, but my only real concern is the people that have those types of boundary issues where the stalking case actually gets to a courtroom, they're already at a point where normal rules and norms don't apply to them. They're being held accountable and they're still not stopping. And so while I agree it may be one of the best avenues to do so, it is also, by the time the stalker gets to that position, I don't know that anyone's going to be able to get through them is really the problem. Because, I mean, that's if you're being criminally charged, you've really violated some rules, boundaries, and laws.
When you have someone who has, let's say, considerable impulse control, and that's a common behavior trait when it comes to stalking, how far can you push in the courts to basically have them re-exhibit or showcase something of that that may not be based around the subject that they're defending themselves against?
So that's really going to be the attorney's job to demonstrate just how scary this person is. And so if I was representing the person that was being stalked, you work to get an explosion out of the person. Because a lot of them are intelligent. A lot of them are well-spoken. And a lot of them can articulate a story that, at least on the surface level, may say, hey, yeah, it's not really that much stalking. Really, they don't really mean it type thing. But if you get a really good attorney that knows how to push the appropriate buttons to get them to explode, is because you want the court to see who that person is. I mean, that happens in domestic violence cases as well. You carefully craft your questions as the attorney representing the victim to get the other person's true personality to come through. And sometimes it's easy to do, sometimes it's not easy to do. The smarter the perpetrator, the more difficult it can become. But you do it long enough, you get to learn the pressure points.
These questions are coming from a point of naivete when it comes to the law and how the procedure works.
Correct.
The reason I'm sort of building this up is that many survivors that we bring forward on Strictly Stalking basically have to build their own cases and they have to build all these things. So what are some of those arsenals? What are some of those little moments of hope they can potentially look forward to? Because you've had the experience. You've been in the courts. You've been in hundreds, if not thousands of cases. So you've seen this, everything from stalking to DV to SA. You've seen all this stuff. So you have a perspective that very few people have when it comes to understanding the behavior and the accountability and potential liability of a stalker.
You bring up an interesting point. I, whether fortunately or unfortunately, have experience in those particular areas. What I have learned, you can't always get to the root of it with some of these stalkers because they become obsessed over something that you just can't get to the bottom of, right? But there are some where you can get to the bottom of the obsession. so that you can figure out what the trigger is to either avoid it, to redirect it, to find a way to distract their attention to focus on something else. I mean, I even do that in my divorce cases. It's they come to see me and they talk about, well, they did this wrong, they did this wrong, they did this wrong. And I'm like, but that's not really why you're getting divorced. Let's talk about the real reason of why this person, your soon-to-be ex, is this angry and upset. Because a lot of times, stalkers result from intimate partner dating or intimate partner relationships. And so you will have husbands or wives that turn into stalkers in the middle of a divorce. They'll put tracking devices on your car, tracking devices in the kids' backpacks. They'll put the kids with their Apple Watches on, with the GPS that you're tracking, so they always know where the kids are with you. I mean, quite often these cases turn into, there is some stalking that happens in these high contested cases, divorce cases. But if you can get to what they're angry about and somehow resolve that base anger, then maybe you can help diffuse or deflect or redirect it to something else. Now, some people are going to say that's a pie in the sky, and it may be, but what do you have to lose by trying to analyze and figure out really what the basis of it is? I had one case where the woman became obsessed with really harming the guy as it related to his relationship with his daughter, and was willing to make up basically any story to make that happen, including sexual abuse. And at the very bottom of the case was her bitterness because my client never married her. That's what it all boiled down to. 2 years of litigation, jury trial, the whole nine yards. I mean, one of the more complex minutiae cases I've handled. And it literally came down to she was bitter because he never married her.
Can you tell me more about how you dug in? Like, what questions were you asking her to get to the bottom of that?
So for me, with that particular one, it became apparent as I was reviewing the evidence. Because every time she filed a criminal complaint against him for an assault that did not occur, I mean, it was literally, she would make up assaults. She would make up that he was committing these crimes that he wasn't. And every single time she called law enforcement, she would make sure to tell whoever was at the law enforcement officer that showed up that they had a child together, he never married her, and he was sleeping around, and she found condoms in his truck. Every single time she called the police. And then when she didn't get the result from the police that she wanted, then she'd go to the police station to go complain and then reiterate kind of the same story that he cheated on her. He had all these lovers. And that was her consistent story. And so when I had her on the stand, and I had her on the stand numerous times through numerous hearings, it was kind of the same thing. And it's fact, my paralegal and I had a discussion about, you know, as we're preparing to go to hearings, well, we can ask her, I said, I'm going to go down the same rabbit hole again. Well, you think she's going to say the same thing? I said, oh, yeah. I said, she's not only going to double down, she's going to triple down. By the time we got to the jury trial, she quadrupled down on the story. And so it became really clear that this whole litigation, the whole attempt to destroy his relationship with his daughter, was because he never married her.
One of the things that I find common through so many stalking scenarios is how much ego plays into these scenarios. And I think you've just capsulized that in terms of how much people cannot take rejection. I've seen this hundreds of times at this point. Where is that line between someone who has a healthy ego that can move on and other ones that don't and end up doing something because they need resolution and their resolution isn't ethical, isn't moral, isn't even legal, but they keep pushing. Then they end up breaking the law. How many times, Michelle, have you seen people who have had, let's say, great careers, great lives, but they something about a breakup sends them down a path to become a stalker?
I probably have seen more than most simply because I ran the protective order court in Far West Texas for about 5 years. And so I saw all the protective orders, right? Well, not all. I saw probably 90% of the protective orders in that county. That was a fairly large county. to say that you see it a fair amount, I would say you do see it a fair amount because they don't want to be told no. It's a how dare they reject me? I did everything for that person. How dare they reject me? How dare they move on? What does that person have they moved on with that I don't have or I have it? Did they not see it? I'm going to make sure they see it. What's really interesting is that when you would have some of these cases come to court and some of these protective order applications that would come to court, the way some of the people, the litigants in the courtroom would dress for the hearing was clearly a see what you're missing outfit. Which I really think is the other part of it that's really an interesting dynamic, because I oftentimes saw the victim come in with the this is what you're missing outfit. And I think those were really interesting. And I couldn't tell you if those were ones that I denied more often than not, but I can tell you this, that if someone was coming into court on either side with the this is what you're missing attitude, that for me set off red flags as to some of the veracity of what their story was going to be. You know, you never judge the people that are coming from the shelters for what they're wearing. They can't help what they're coming to court in. And so in the particular court that I presided over, there was a probably more lax dress code because of the nature of where people may have been coming from to prevail themselves in a courtroom of their legal rights. There were others that were not in that circumstance and were very much come to the court dressed in nines to really show the other side. And it could have been the victim or it could have been the respondent who they were seeking a protective order against would say, this is what you're missing. I remember one guy came in with his shirt unbuttoned down to like his belly button and he had like a hairy chest and he had like gold chains on. And he was one that the protective order was being sought against. And I looked at my bailiff and I was like, Reuben, because that never should have been allowed to come into court with basically his hairy chest on display.
It might have backfired.
I'm telling you, it backfired. If you are in the armed forces and if you really are the perpetrator, do not come to court in your military attire, your dress uniforms. That's not going to help your credibility. It is not going to help your credibility if the evidence is most likely going to show that you beat up your significant other. And quite frankly, it's going to make you look worse because you're trying to use the uniform to hide your actions. So I'm going to tell you, that one drove me nuts when I had military personnel who had clearly done wrong come into court and they're either their dress or their fatigues, or forgive me for getting the vernacular wrong. But they would absolutely come in dressed to the nines with their sergeant or their supervisor there, led to their credibility as a witness. And I got to tell you, that doesn't help your credibility. Not beating up your significant other helps your credibility.
When you're in a position where, as a lawyer, a client comes to you and they start to reveal things about, let's say, their life or their behavior or things that happen in the heat of the divorce, how often would you say, percentage-wise, does stalking, surveilling, harassment come up in the divorce cases you handle from either side?
Routinely, it comes up with the Nest cameras. I can't tell you how often when one party moves out, we've got to make sure the Nest cameras are changed, the logins are changed, the Wi-Fi password is changed. It happens quite, I wouldn't say all the time because that'd be a misstatement, but to say it happens with more frequency than it should, absolutely. But think about that. Think about why. You have a couple that's breaking up for whatever reason. Almost always there's going to be a jilted party. It's either someone got cheated on, they didn't see the divorce coming, it came out of left field, or it's, I don't care what you've done, who you've slept with, I'll be damned if you're leaving me. Right? And so you typically have a jilted side. And what happens when you have a jilted side? They think the rules don't apply to them because they want to find out who that side piece is, why that person is choosing them, why they want a divorce after this many years, why after putting up with their, what they're going to say is crap for 20 years from this person, how dare they leave me? I'm going to show him or her. And so they stalk them. But the problem is they don't think of it as stalking. Because, at least in Texas, where it's a community property state, well, I own that car too. I pay for that cell phone too. It's my account as well. It's part mine, so I can go get it or I can access it. And that's just not what happens or not what should happen.
How has your own divorce impacted how you look at family law, at divorce, and at couples just starting relationships? What kind of things should they look out for?
It gives me an additional perspective into how difficult separating from the person you've been with for so long can be. And it's difficult for a multitude of reasons, but it's not just difficult because you're separating from someone you've been with for over 2.5 decades. You have to learn how to live all over again by yourself. And anyone that's in a relationship knows you talk to that person 8 times a day. Whether you're sad, mad, angry, glad, you still talk to that person, and that changes when you get divorced. It's a person that even though you all may be pissed off at each other, it's you two at the end of the day against the world. That changes. And the traits that you disliked about your partner only amplify once you get divorced, because they don't have to restrain themselves anymore. And if you think for any second that the person that you are divorcing is somehow going to change who they are in the divorce and become reasonable when they weren't reasonable in the marriage, you're fooling yourself. It's only going to get worse.
Now that you have actually experienced the thing that you have fought so hard for in court, for so many people, basically trying to repair or trying to give someone a new start at a new life post-divorce. Who do you turn to now?
Can I say it's the two people I'm talking to right now? I mean, Jake, let's be real clear. If you would get up earlier in the mornings, I would talk to you earlier too, but you don't. So instead, I have to resort to 3 a.m. with you.
Well, 3 a.m. to you is 1 a.m. to me. So there's a good chance pretty much every day when you get up, I'm probably up. Gabby, we don't know your sleep schedule, but I can tell you is that I tend to work late into the evening generally.
Late into the evenings? Can we call bullshit? You work into the wee hours of the morning. That is different until late evening.
Fair enough. Not always, but I'd say 90% of the time. Pretty much
99.99997% of the time.
Do you know what the benefits are of working that late? Is
yeah, no phone calls.
Up. No one is up. No one is available. Like you know what I'm saying? Like that's the whole thing too. It's like no one has access to you because they're sleeping.
Except for people like me who are perimenopausal and our hormones wake us up about 3 a.m. like clockwork. And then I can text you because I know it's 1 a.m. and you're still up.
I've been surrounded by, raised by women my entire life, but you actually bring a whole new flavor to
PMS
that I've never, well, to PMS, to everything.
Wait, because you had to go buy me Spanx last time we were in LA.
Oh, that was glorious. That was literally the highlight of my career.
When you take being an executive producer to the next level.
We need to make sure those Spanx fit right. Because if Michelle's not happy, no one's happy.
That would be such an accurate statement. Thank you for joining us today on this week's episode of Love, Lust, Raw. Jake Deptula is my executive producer and does a fabulous job. Thank you for tuning in, learning, and listening, and can't wait for y'all to listen again. You can also tune in to our Instagram lives at 4 p.m. every Friday. The month of January and the first part of February has been reserved for Stalking Awareness Month. Thank you.